States v. Gutierrez. Ms. Wood.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Lisa Wood, and I represent Appellant Oscar Gutierrez in this matter. The issue before the Court today is whether the good faith exception outlined in Davis v. the United States applies to this case. And very simply, it does not. It does not because the officers here did not act in strict compliance with binding appellate precedent when they conducted the search at issue here. And it does not because their behavior was wrongful and warrants the application of the exclusionary rule. Before I get into my argument, I think on both sides there's been a lot of comparisons between this case and the Supreme Court's decision in Cardenas v. the United States, and that's natural because both cases are very factually similar. However, the conduct that occurred in this case and in Cardenas, a physical intrusion into a constitutionally protected space without a warrant and without consent, that conduct has been prohibited by the Fourth Amendment long before the Cardenas opinion is issued. And I think the opinion itself makes that clear. We have decades, if not centuries, of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence that tells us that, all the way from Alderman versus the United States to Olmstead versus the United States, and more recently, and perhaps more apt to this situation, Jones versus the United States, the Supreme Court's decision in 2012, which specifically reaffirmed the trespass principle in the Fourth Amendment, specifically affirmed the fact that law enforcement cannot physically intrude into a protected area without a warrant and without consent. And so this is not a situation, as the government contends, where the officers in this case were not on notice that their behavior was wrongful.
Now, in the record, there's really no real description of the porch, right? The size of it or anything like that.
That's correct. I believe at the very end of the transcript of the motion to suppress evidence, it is made clear that it is. I'm wrong. That was the garage. But you're right. There is no description of the porch. However, I don't think there is a dispute over the fact that porch is within the curtilage of the home.
Well, under the Davis exception, we have to apply the laws that stood at the time of the search, as you acknowledge. Pre-Jardin courts generally did not consider the porch to be part of the home's curtilage. Can you point us to any cases pre-Jardin, a Seventh Circuit case that says, as a rule, that all porches are part of the curtilage?
At this moment, I cannot judge. However, I do think that porch. Well, I think if you look at the court's decision, the Supreme Court's decision, I believe it's Kennedy versus King, where they talk a little bit about whether or not law enforcement is permitted to how much leeway law enforcement is permitted to have once they're on the porch. And while that deals with a different issue, I think implicit in that holding is the fact that that porch area is within the curtilage of the home.
Your adversary points to Glock and Hoop, and that gives me two questions. One is, through whose eyes do we look at what is binding judicial precedent? I mean, Glock, the officers were already inside the common areas of the home with consent, so they were going into someone's private bedroom that had a sign on the outside of it. Hoop is even closer to our case, and Hoop really is just about as close to our case as I think as you could reasonably expect to find a precedent. But Hoop's an Indiana appellate court decision. If you're a state law enforcement officer are you bound by both Hoop and Block, and therefore should we look at it that way, or should we look at it by the fact that we're federal judges sitting in a federal court, and that's our binding precedent for judges in this building is what comes from the Seventh Circuit and the Supreme Court, and we judges in this building would not be bound by the Indiana Court of Appeals, and nor would the district judge in this case have been bound, but the officers were. If they're state officers, they're responsible both to the Indiana Appellate Court and the Indiana Supreme Court and the federal authorities, and I suppose answerable in damages under 1983 for violations of that. What do you think?
Well, first of all, this was a task force operation, so there were both federal law enforcement agents and state police officers, so this was a combined task force. I think the answer is that you look at it through the judge's eyes. While there hasn't been a whole lot of litigation on this matter, the courts that have interpreted the phrase binding appellate precedent after Davis have specifically interpreted it as a in-circuit United States Court of Appeals decision or a Supreme Court decision. And while this court and the First Circuit have in dicta said that it may expand to other circuits, there has been nothing, no law to say that a state court decision on a federal court would be binding in this situation. There's been no law to say that we look at it through the law enforcement agency.
And I guess my question is, does that make sense? Because some of the officers were federal, some of the officers were state, but let's say you're a state police officer and you're going to approach a home, you could be held liable under 1983, I assume, if you violate, you know, let's say the state's made a state constitution is, or the state court has made some proclamation about what clearly established law is, couldn't you?
I would imagine that you could.
So why wouldn't it make sense to look at it through the eyes of the officer? Because the officer may not know. I suppose in this case, if it's a task force, they probably were going to be prosecuted in federal court, but you don't always know that. And so we get cases sometimes where state has made the arrest and the federal government takes it over later. You don't know a fortiori where you're going to be. Why would it matter?
That's true. However, I think in this case that the Jones decision by the United States Supreme Court really controlled. It was decided after Hoop. And I don't think that Hoop is good law after Jones, because Jones really reaffirms that trespass principle. And the conduct in this case was really arguably more intrusive than the conduct in Jones, which is just putting a GPS device on the bottom of the car. This was going up to the porch of a home, knocking, and when they didn't receive an answer, and according to the law enforcement agency, saw indications that the people within the home did not want to talk to them, remained on the porch, brought the dog up to the porch, conducted the dog sniff, and then even after that, stayed on the porch and conducted their investigation for 15 more minutes. That is incredibly intrusive. And so I think that even if you were looking through it from a law enforcement officer's perspective, that decision controls. Moreover, there are no other Indiana appellate court decisions, nor is there an Indiana Supreme Court decision that confirms Hoop's holding. As I note in my brief, there's only three other decisions that I could find, and those are scattered about the country and are, of course, non-binding.
And Hoop really relies on Block. So
correct.
Why isn't Block the controlling law here until Jardines?
Why isn't it? Because
yeah.
Block does not involve an intrusion into a constitutionally protected space. There, as this court made very clear, the decision was primarily based on the fact that the law enforcement officers had valid consent to be inside the home.
But not in the bedroom where they actually found the drugs, right?
Well, they never went into the bedroom. They were in a common area, and the dog sniff was conducted in a common area. And, of course, there's no curtilage exception for outside of a bedroom door. You don't have that expectation of privacy there. So the only analysis done was the privacy analysis. and the holding was that a dog sniff did not violate that defendant's reasonable expectation of privacy. However, there was no analysis done on the physical intrusion because there wasn't one. And so that's why Brock doesn't apply in this situation.
Now, what about Leon? Because why doesn't that good faith exception apply? Because as I understand it, the officers entered the home after they were instructed to do so by an assistant state's attorney. Is that what the record shows?
Well, they entered the home. However, that was after the dog sniff in this case.
Right, it was after the dog sniff. But then the assistant state's attorney told them they could go ahead and enter, not to wait for the warrant, right?
That's right. They didn't have to wait for the warrant to enter. However, they didn't search until they got that warrant.
Exactly. And so what I'm saying is they're going in. Don't they have the – can't they rely on an assistant state's attorney who says, go on in, you don't have to wait for the warrant? Isn't that a –
well,
didn't Leon apply in that kind of circumstance? Because there's no indication that there was state's attorney lied or was misrepresenting something or there was any hanky-panky with the state's attorney, right?
I don't think there is in the record. I would respectfully disagree. I think that the contraband in this case is a fruit of first the initial search, the initial dog sniff, and then the search warrant, because there was no search done until the search warrant got to the
home. I guess what I'm saying, if the law is unclear about whether or not they could do the sniff, because it's unclear whether or not a porch is part of the curtilage, because the law was a little unsettled then, so you've got that, and then once they get in and they do the search, isn't that another way to justify it under Leon, that they were instructed to go in and not to wait?
Well, I think the Leon issue has been waived in this proceeding. It is the government's burden to make those arguments, and that argument was never made below. In fact, it was specifically discounted, as I point to in my brief, so I would consider it waived.
And you don't think this court can look at Leon without it being fully briefed? Is that your position?
That would be my position, but even if you could, I don't think Leon applies. Leon involved a search warrant where it was later determined that the affidavit didn't constitute probable cause to search. This search warrant involves a recitation of facts that includes a Fourth Amendment violation. And in those situations, I think the cases instruct us to do the independent source analysis. Is there an independent source for the discovery of the contraband when you excise the Fourth Amendment violation from that search warrant? And the answer here is clearly no. The search warrant without the information about the positive dog sniff is woefully woefully without probable cause. It involves a confidential informant who did not appear before the magistrate. And that's it. The cases make clear, as I've set out in my briefs, that is not enough to constitute probable cause. And you also look at whether or not a search warrant would have been applied for had that initial Fourth Amendment violation not have occurred. And in this case, it certainly would not have, because there was not enough information with which they could have applied for the search warrant. I see my time is up, but if there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. Wood.
Thank you.
Mr. McCoskey.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. This Court should affirm the judgment of the District Court below. On November 13, 2012, at the date and time that the dog sniff at issue in this case took place, there were two legal principles that were at issue in the governing case law in existence at that time. The first was, and is, that there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in contraband, in hiding contraband, in particular narcotics. And so the Supreme Court, this court, other courts have held that when a dog sniff by a trained narcotics detection canine finds that contraband and nothing else, it's a non-intrusive use of a tool, a law enforcement tool that does not amount to a Fourth Amendment search. The second principle is that law enforcement officers, just like any other member of the public, are entitled to approach the front door of a residence via the porch, via any route that a member of the public could use to get to the front door and inquire, speak with someone. And that part is even if they have some law enforcement purpose in mind when they speak with the person. So those were the two legal principles at issue, the legal principles that were also discussed in this court's opinion in Brock and also in the Indiana Court of Appeals decision in Hoop, both of which, of course, are cited in the brief. Those sort of established the legal playing field, if you will, at the time that this dog sniff took place.
And but so, now you argue that Hoop cites a number of cases that stand for the proposition that dog sniffs conducted at or inside residence or other private locations don't qualify as searches under the Fourth. But those cases did not involve houses where a search took place in the home's curtilage or the police were lawfully on the premises, so a dog sniff could occur without offending the Fourth Amendment. Do you have a case where a dog sniff occurred in a curtilage area, no Fourth Amendment exception applied, and the search did not violate the Fourth Amendment?
Well, Your Honor, those cases, and even this court's Brock opinion, I believe, relied on the notion that there was no reasonable expectation of privacy and did not discuss the physical intrusion element, which, of course, the Supreme Court, the reasoning of the Supreme Court in the Jardines opinion was this is a physical intrusion. So I think Hoop and Brock and the cases cited in those two cases could reasonably rely on this wealth of case law discussing the fact that there's no privacy interest, no reasonable expectation of privacy that's been violated by a dog sniff, whether it's at the threshold of a door to a locked door to a bedroom inside an apartment, as was the case in Brock, or whether or not, as in this case, and as in Jardines until the Supreme Court told us otherwise, it was at the front door of a residence.
So your bottom line is that you're saying that pre-Jardines, an officer who conducted a knock and talk in the curtilage was lawfully on the premises to conduct the law enforcement action?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a Seventh Circuit case that says that?
No, there's not, Your Honor.
Then doesn't that mean that an officer needs a legal reason to conduct a dog sniff in the home's curtilage, which didn't exist here?
Your Honor, I think that because a dog sniff has long been recognized as not a search under the Fourth Amendment, the officer did not need to be able to articulate some reason and get a warrant before bringing the dog to the front door as of the time the sniff took place here. Jardines, of course, makes that a different proposition because now we're talking about a physical intrusion into a protected zone in the curtilage. But the state law enforcement officer, and this was a state law enforcement officer, to address a question that came up earlier from Judge Dow, Detective Sergeant Klein had no reason to believe, and that's a subjective, I know a subjective intent doesn't matter, but no reasonably trained state law enforcement officer would have any reason to believe that what he did in bringing that canine to the front door would end up being a violation of the Fourth Amendment as of the time that the dog sniff took place.
Well, what about the Dunn case, which was a four-factor test?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The Dunn case, which was a four-factor test that was established, and, you know, were each of those factors met, and was that applicable pre-Jardines?
Your Honor, I think, again, as I've set forth in the brief, I think the fact that the officer was lawfully entitled to be on the front step, as courts have recognized, the knock and talk is an accepted procedure. There's not a reason, there's nothing that an officer would have to establish as far as reasonable suspicion or anything higher to approach the front step or front door of a residence. So he was lawfully entitled to be there, and then, of course, again, in reliance on the long line of dog sniff case law, I don't think the factors were necessary for the officer to meet before going to the front door of Mr. Gutierrez's residence.
And can you speak to the Leon case and also whether or not there's been a waiver?
Yes, Your Honor. And I do agree that the government did not raise the Leon issue as a specific independent reason for denying the motion to suppress. But But as to Leon specifically, Your Honor, I think the question, the broader question is the good faith test, which of course Leon established, which is whether or not a reasonably well-trained officer in the situation the officer was in here would know or have reason to know that the search, the dog sniff, would be in violation of the Constitution. And I would say based on Hoop and on Brock and on the cases that those cases relied on, there would be no reason for a well-trained officer, a reasonably well-trained officer, to have that belief. But as to the Leon issue specifically, that is true. We did not raise that as an independent basis, Your Honor. What I mentioned in my brief, I think, was fair to raise as a response, that is, that officers could rely in good faith on a warrant that was issued by a state magistrate judge that himself, as the district court found, could reasonably rely on all this case law we've been discussing. So when an officer has a warrant in hand, and actually they sought the warrant, they went through the steps required to get the warrant, swore out an affidavit, and went back to the house and found the contraband at issue only after the issuance of the warrant and the execution of the warrant, I think that Leon would apply. But I think it's part of the good faith, it's another facet of the good faith argument I'm making in the brief, but it is true I didn't raise that independently below.
Can I ask you a question about the difference between, if any, between Brock and this case? So if you go to the door, if you're going to walk and knock and talk, so to speak, and it's just an officer knocking the door, that's one scenario. If you've got kind of a knock, talk, and bark thing where you brought your dog with you, and so in Brock, my understanding at least is that they have been given consent to go into the common area, but not consent anything beyond that. The dog alerted to a door which was in an area that they hadn't been given consent. Is that any different in any material way than the scenario we have with us today?
Your Honor, I think that the consent issue is a little bit of a curveball that at the end of the day, it shouldn't matter, Your Honor, because the officers in Brock were entitled to be where they were lawfully because of the consent issue. They were entitled to be in this living space outside the door, the locked door, to another living space, which, of course, where the contraband was found. In this case, based on what the officers could reasonably know as of the time of the sniff, they were lawfully entitled to be on the front door, on the curtilage of Mr. Gutierrez's residence with a canine, a narcotics detection canine. So I think ultimately at the end of the day, Your Honor, that the analysis, if Hardeen's, of course, had never been decided, I think it'd be obviously a very easy issue, Your Honor, but Hardeen's now has thrown into the mix this notion of a physical intrusion, and that's the other distinction. How that would play out in Brock, if Brock came to this court now post-Hardeen's, I don't know, Your Honor. That might make a difference. It may not. But I think for purposes of this, I think that the Davis good faith exception does ratify the conduct of the officers here and that the district court should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kowski. Ms. Wood, your time has expired, but you had extensive questioning, so you may have an additional minute.
Just two quick points, Your Honor. First of all, Jardine's wasn't the case that threw into the mix this prohibition against physical intrusions into constitutionally protected spaces. That prohibition has been around for as long as the Fourth Amendment has, and that's really why the Fourth Amendment was enacted. And if I need to point to an opinion that makes that even clearer than Hardeen's, it's Jones, which was decided before the search in this case took place. And so the officers were clearly on notice that their conduct offended the Fourth Amendment. And this wasn't just a knock-and-talk attempt, and this wasn't just a bringing the dog up. This was continuing to remain on the porch right outside the front door of the residence for 15 minutes after that dog positively alerted, conducting an investigation. And so that conduct, when it was clear that the residents were either not home or clearly didn't want to talk to the officers, which was within their rights, it is clear that that conduct offended the Fourth Amendment. Secondly, I think that looking at Jones, Jones doesn't say, well, if one circuit, if our circuit doesn't prohibit something, then law enforcement, you know, can do it. It says that law enforcement should rely on binding appellate precedent. And it uses that phrase over and over again, specific reliance on binding appellate precedent. So their specific action should be authorized by courts before they do it. And that's because we need to avoid the situation where law enforcement is forced to think about what could be the law sometime in the future. We need to avoid that. We need to deter that. That is the court's job. And so there was no binding appellate precedent that authorized law enforcement's action in this case. And for that reason and the other reasons I've raised in my briefs, I would ask this court remand the case.
Thank you, Ms. Wood. Thank you, Ms. McCoskey.
Thank you.
Ms. Wood, you and Mr. Brayman were appointed in this case, and you have the additional thanks to the court for ably representing your client. Thank you. Court will stand in recess.